Hello and welcome to the Jewish Studies channel on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Moses Lappin, and today I'm joined by Professor Noam Zadoff to talk about his recent book, Gershon Scholem, From Berlin to Jerusalem and Back, an Intellectual Biography, published by Brandeis University Press in 2018. Professor Zadoff is an assistant professor of Jewish Studies and of History and the director of the Olamot Center at Indiana University, Bloomington. Our topic of conversation today is Gershon Scholem, From Berlin to Jerusalem and Back, in which, picking up from Scholem's own autobiography, with his arrival in Jerusalem in 1923, uniquely, Professor Zadoff situates his thought in the context of his biography, with particular focus on his ongoing relationship to Germany and German thought. The book is divided into three sections that focus on Scholem's early period in Jerusalem, his political activities, relationship to the Hebrew language, and to the Hebrew University. The next section is about Scholem's response to the Holocaust and the pivotal role he played in collecting and reclaiming manuscripts and books that were formerly the inheritance of the Jewish communities of Europe. Lastly, and perhaps the most revealing section of the book, Professor Zadoff focuses on Scholem's return to Germany and his reception there. Although he continued to live in Israel, he began once again publishing in German and was accepted amongst German intellectuals and received in the popular imagination of the German people. I had a wonderful time reading the book, and I'm excited to have its author with us today. Good morning, Professor Zadoff. I'm excited for this opportunity to discuss your book. And to begin, may you tell us a little bit about yourself and how you came to write Gershon Scholem from Berlin to Jerusalem and back.
Yes, thank you very much, and good morning. Well, the story of the writing of this book begins in Jerusalem, actually, at the Hebrew University, where I studied Machshevet Israel, that is Jewish studies, with an emphasis on Kabbalah. There, Gershom Scholem and his figure was, of course, very dominant and prominent, and you could almost feel him hovering over the corridors of Mount Scopus. And questions that are dealing with Gershom Scholem and his figure were always part of my studying years. But then, reading his biography, I suddenly realized that it was ended, actually, when Gershom Scholem was only 27 years old. And he didn't write any sequel or any continuation that reveals more about the later chapters of his life. And this was the moment that I asked myself, what is the strategical thought of autobiographical writing? What were the reasons that made Scholem choose to end his biography at this early point? What is it there that he didn't want the reader to know? And then I came to look at the history of the publication of the book, and I saw that it was first published actually in German and in Germany, and not in Hebrew. And the Hebrew translation is only a later one. It's an elaborated translation, but it's a later one. And therefore, I tried to see this narrative, this one way to re-examine or revise this one way narrative of from Berlin to Jerusalem, a story that begins in one place and ends in one place. And I wanted to see and examine what happened with Berlin after Scholem arrived to Jerusalem and stopped telling the story of his transition from Europe to Palestine. And this is how I got to the book.
The subtitle of the book labels it an intellectual biography. And although rather than simply focus on his writings about Jewish history and Zionism and Kabbalah, you situate his thought within a wider narrative that focuses on the various contexts in which Scholem himself thought. Could you please just describe the book and the structure of the book for our readers?
Yes, of course. The book actually picks up, it structures chronologically and really picks up the thread at the same point that Scholem left it, upon his arrival to Jerusalem and his appointment as a lecturer at the Institute for Jewish Studies at the Hebrew University. And after locating the background of this atmosphere or this moment, I go on to describe what were his activities at the time. And while researching, I realized that Gershom Scholem, probably as many of us, moved and acted within social networks. His intellectual networks and the thoughts of or the thought of which he was a part and which he was sharing, he was always sharing with others. And then I wanted to reveal or started to examine some of those networks. For example, the circle of Brit Shalom, of the bi-nationalist group of professor of the Hebrew University. Most of them were Central European origin, speaking German. Or another smaller circle of which Sholem was not part, Hugaol, the Yoke circle, whom also acted or met in Rehavia and was part of exchange about the meaning of religion at the time. And then slowly, following those German-speaking network, I saw that they lead back to Germany, and they lead back to Germany mainly after the Holocaust. And the Holocaust is the event that stands actually at the center of the book, even if it's not, if I'm not talking directly or not writing directly about it, because Sholem himself almost never referred directly to the Holocaust. I still think that it is probably Gershom Sholem's major turning point in his life, where he lost both his closest brother, Bana Sholem, who died in 1940, a communist who died in 1940 at the Buchenwald concentration camp, or Walter Benjamin, who died in the Pyrenees in Port Bou, fleeing from Nazi or occupied France. And those deaths and these events really affected him, even, or maybe because of that, he didn't write about it. And slowly I discovered, or by reading the material, that one of the major things that the Holocaust served as a turning point is that it marked actually a way of a return to Germany, an intellectual return to Germany. And this had to do both with the potential of the role he could play in Germany, as well as his, what I called, disillusionment with his own private Zionist utopia.
The subtitle of the book, From Berlin to Jerusalem and Back, echo and yet are in some way in opposition to the title of Sholem's own autobiography. Your subtitle suggests that there's more to the life story, as you mentioned, than a simple tale of progress that begins in Berlin and ends in Jerusalem. And you mentioned just now that the Holocaust was a moment of this turn in Sholem's life. And later on in the book, you mentioned a second turn of his return to Germany. Could you reflect for a moment on these sort of turns in his life, this return to Germany?
Yes. Well, in order to do that, we'll have to look about what, or examine what was exactly Sholem's Zionism or Zionist conviction. And Sholem's Zionism was not far from the mainstream. It was a very individualistic one and very idealistic one, who saw the fulfillment of Jewish national aspirations not in the form of a state or a political organization, but actually in the spirit of Ahad Am, the famous Jewish writer and journalist. He saw it as a cultural building, a cultural center in Palestine, in Eretz Israel at the time. The events and the way they were developed at the bloody events of 1929, and then afterwards the Holocaust itself, showed Sholem that in a very ironical and sad way, his own utopia cannot be fulfilled. Not because something went wrong, not only with Zionism, something went wrong, but the circumstances around the world made it to be that what was needed is actually shelter for Jews, physical shelter, and not and the prospect of having first a cultural center is actually irrelevant. And this disillusionment was central in Sholem's, or is central in Sholem's thought during those years. And you can see that it actually brought him, in a way, to look for a different, or to redefine his own place in Germany or among German circles and social networks. For example, after the war, although going and searching for looted Jewish books in devastated Europe brought Sholem almost to a point of a mental collapse, and he returned to his home in the neighborhood of Chavya, really a broken man. That was in 1946, at the fall of 1946. In 1949, he was in Switzerland participating in the Eranos meetings, Eranos conference, who was actually founded by no other than Carl Gustav Jung, who is known for his affiliation to the Nazi movement in the early 30s. So the question is, or how could it be, or what is the reason for Sholem to do such a step, or to move part, at least part of his intellectual activity, back to Switzerland? And that had to do, of course, with the nature of the meetings, the nature of those were the Eranos meetings, were meetings that took place once a year at the lovely village of Ascona on Lago Maggiore, in which religious scholars of religion from all over the world took part. And they were taking, combining academic activity with a lot of leisure. The format was 10 days in which there were 10 presentations and one presentation a day of 1.5 hours. And the rest of the day was dedicated just to eating around the big table, bathing in the sea, in the lake, having conversation with colleagues. And this environment and atmosphere was very attractive and charming to Sholem. But from Eranos, it went on and moved on to a different network, which was the Zurkamp Publishing House in Frankfurt, where first his books, his German books, were published in a Swiss publisher, Jewish Swiss publisher in Zurich. After a while, after this publisher was not active anymore, he was bought by Zurkamp Verlag, Zurkamp Publishing House in Frankfurt. And so the center of the activity of Sholem spread beyond Switzerland, also back to Germany, where he was received and accepted as a central figure, in an ironical way, a true German, since he disappeared, or since he escaped or went away from Germany before the big catastrophe. He could serve as a model, as a role model for a younger German generation who could not trust the generation of the parents anymore because of the moral corruption. And this is what brought him, or gave him, this special stand in Germany.
Thank you for that succinct summary of the book. I think that really encapsulates much of the structure and summarizes the content of the book. Before we move on to a closer reading of some of your arguments in the book and some of the interesting things that you bring out of Sholem's life, I wanted to reflect briefly on the method that you write the book. It's interesting because you're writing a book about Sholem that continues on from his autobiography. So I was wondering if you could briefly reflect on this. What was it like to write a biography in the shadow of an autobiography?
Well, the strategies of the person who's writing his own life, and the person who's writing the life of a different, of someone else, are, of course, and totally different. You know, what I found interesting in this touching point, this point where Sholem's autobiography and my book touched, I found it interesting to not only critically examine Sholem's autobiography, but also to give it a place, a structure in my biography. In my book, for me, to understand Sholem's From Berlin to Jerusalem, the context of Gershom Sholem's life, you have to look for the role that it played. And what I realized is that the whole book, this whole narrative of one-way movement from Berlin to Jerusalem, was actually created in order to allow Gershom Sholem a sort of a return to Germany. By telling the story of leaving Germany in German to German audience, he was accepted as not only as an authentic Jew, but also as an authentic German back into the German academic world, which he left when he was very young. This doesn't mean that this was happening only, or that he totally turned his back away on Israel. He was still active in Israel, of course. He was the head of the Israeli Academy of Sciences. He was very present in the Israeli academic world. It was not a clear, straightforward return. It was he was a half returnee in that sense. That means that he didn't give up his identity as an Israeli, but he was more and more being present academically among different German institutions, writing in German, publishing in German. He stopped the last book that he published originally in Hebrew was in 1957, which is quite early in his career. From that on, this monography on Shabtai Tzvi was practically his last monograph that he wrote in Hebrew. And from that on, he wrote only in English and in German, and more than in the U.S., although he was very much present in the U.S. as well. But more than that, he was emotionally attached to Germany. So the biography, my biography, had to also look not only on Gershom Scholem's life, and not only about the way he described his own life in his autobiography, but to locate the place that Scholem's, or the role that Scholem's autobiography plays in his own life.
We're going to take a bit of a closer look at the book now. Part one of your book, entitled Continuity of the Crisis, Hope and Disillusion, 1923 to 1938, begins by exploring Scholem's political commitments upon his arrival in Jerusalem, particularly his relationship, as you mentioned before, to Brit Shalom and the events of 1929, as well as his relationship to other types of Zionism. You mentioned Achad HaAm, amongst others. Could you expand on this a little bit?
So one of the main challenges that awaited Scholem when arriving to Jerusalem was the fact that he was living a very central and vivid Jewish atmosphere in Berlin and in Frankfurt and in Bad Homburg and in Munich, and arriving actually into a peripheral colony of the British Empire. A town, Jerusalem, was a city in which cultural life was nothing to compare with what you could find in the major city of Europe at the time. This, at the same time, it was a city that was, or it was a time where Jerusalem was developing and things were happening, like the Hebrew University and the different circles, the Rehavia neighborhood, which was being built back then. And more people who immigrated and arrived created an own, community of Zionists over there. And part of it was activity, or the beginning or the continuation of a literary activity and science, European type of science. And in all this, Scholem took part, and this was part of his own growth. The political circles, as I mentioned, were part of it, but they're also close to the Hebrew University and part of these different communities.
That's great. I think that does cover some of the major points of that first section, and does segue actually into your next piece, which is about the Hebrew University. One of the things that you tackle in your book, and something that's very difficult to understand in Scholem's biography, particularly in light of your research about his reception in Germany, is the image that he had in Israel. As somebody who was one of the founding fathers, I suppose, of the Hebrew University and of Jewish studies in Israel, and as well as in his administrative positions, where he had great power and a lot of influence. Could you continue talking about his involvement in the Hebrew University with other Jerusalem scholars and his administration work, not just in this period, but I suppose as it continues on throughout his life?
Yes, of course. So actually the beginning of Sholem's career, 1925 at the university, are being told, or at least being seen, as going hand in hand with the development of what he sees as developing the field of Kabbalah as an academic field. Now, Sholem very often liked to present himself as someone who did that out of scratch. There was nothing there before, and he brought the field of Kabbalah put it on its feet. And it's not true. There were researchers there. There were people researching in Berlin. There were publishing houses publishing Kabbalah text. But it is true that Gershom Sholem was the first one to institutionalize Kabbalah as an academic field. And by doing that, he had to have immediately, almost instantly, he got belongs to the founding fathers of the Hebrew University with all their attribute that this role brings with it. The first generation of students, Shayahu Tishbi and Yosef Weiss and Chaim Virshuvsky at the 1930s, 40s, was the second or maybe the first generation of scholars of Kabbalah that came out of Sholem School, and their students were actually until recently professors at the students and students of students were professors at the Hebrew University. So in that sense, Gershom Sholem himself is a beginner of some kind of a generation of researchers that are dealing with the field of Kabbalah. As such, he was very often or sometimes very much criticized or even feared of and hated, but at the same time admired. I think that this was also one of the attractions of Germany to Sholem, where he didn't have this role of this father role, and therefore he could act in that sense more freely and be closer to his younger colleagues, which were not his students, but his colleagues at the time. And this also, or moving between the two worlds, had also its charm for Sholem himself. As part of the reception of Sholem, we can see that right after his death in 1982, there was a process, a natural process of father murder or patricide. Where he was actually vehemently criticized by many of his students, but also by other scholars and journalists. I think that what we see now is the post-patricide period, where his figure shines again in that sense, but with its complexity, since now we have the archives, and the archives of Sholem are accessible, and they have vast amounts of material. This is a fertile field for researchers to work in and come out with many different and intriguing conclusions about his rich life and his rich intellectual world.
Outside of the Hebrew University, he was involved during this period, in the pre-state period, amongst the discourse around the creation of the Hebrew language. And there are two figures in particular that you single out in your book, Sholem's relationship with Shai Agnon, and with Chaim Nachman Bialik. What were those relationships like? And really, what was that discourse around the Hebrew language about?
Well, of course, for a cultural Zionist like Sholem, one of the missed features of the revival of the Jewish people was the revival and using of the Jewish language, Hebrew. But Hebrew had a very paradoxical role, or very tricky role in that sense, since it was about, the whole idea was about to revive a dead language or a holy language and make it applicable, make it a usable language. So you don't want to, on the one hand, you don't want to lose the old meaning of the language, and I'll come back to that in a second. But then again, you have to still you have to put it under a process of renewal and make it usable, for example, for children at the playground. For Sholem was very important the idea of the generation of revival, or the generation of transition, to in which to his eye, to his mind, Agnon and Bialik stood. That is, they were rooted in the old Hebrew, in the old Jewish world, but their head were towards the renewal of the language, the national secular renewal of the language. And they kept both worlds in the writing, so to say. They were able to serve for the new generation access, or to provide to the new generation access to the old scripts without losing the meaning. And losing the religious meaning of the language, totally disconnecting the language from its root, was in Sholem's eyes dangerous. He wrote about it in his letter to Franz Rosenzweig, which is, in the meanwhile, one of his most famous letters, when he said that the religious meaning of the language is like almost like an explosive, that you cannot really ignore it, because if you ignore it at a certain point, this all of this religious burden that was put on the language over thousands of years will take its revenge on the people who use it without really knowing its meaning. And this is what he thought that Agnon and Bialik almost remedy, almost they provide. And this is to mitigate this tension between the holy element in the language and the secular one.
How did these early years in Israel, from 1923 until 1938, set the stage for his later work and his later life project? Or perhaps do you believe that the Holocaust and the establishment of the state formed a rupture between these early years and the later years?
I think that there were, before that, you could see beginnings of research and writing in many fields. He's the Major Trends in Jewish Mysticism, who was published really in 1941 at the midst of the Holocaust, was, of course, is still one of his major works, but it is an attempt to explore or to portray a map of Jewish mystical thought and its different types of Jewish mystical thought over the years. It's written chronologically, it has an historical aspect, but I think the idea and the title Major Trends in Jewish Mysticism shows that it had an intention to draw a portrait of the map, of a general map of a Jewish mystical thought. But the major development, his big biography on Shabtai Tzvi, was something that was he started working on in the 40s, but it ended only afterwards. And the work that he'd done after the years of the Holocaust was more, he was vaster and in many other languages, and he returned back also to things that he started before. The Holocaust served as a turning point also in Sholem's research, for example, in the way that he understood the evil in Kabbalah, or the notion that actually the development in Jewish history comes out of trauma. Some of the things were revised and criticized by his pupils and also by his colleagues. And some of them were also stood in the middle of criticism of the time. For example, when he published his work on Jakob Frank, Redemption Through Sin, in 1937, right afterwards he was accused by Orthodox Jewish scholars that actually making a hero of an heretical figure like Jakob Frank is giving authorization to look at malevolent figures like Hitler in a positive way. And Jakob Frank was very often compared to Hitler in that sense. And therefore, Scholem was criticized of being looking favorably at figures as such, which was, of course, not true, but it's still intriguing to ask what was or where did this this interest in trauma in Jewish history and evil or in the parts that are not staying with the conform or going out of the conform in Orthodox Judaism, what do they serve in Scholem's thoughts and ideological world as well?
The center part of your book focuses on Scholem's response to the Holocaust. And before we get there, I was just wondering if you can tell the listeners a little bit about Scholem during the period of the Holocaust. You mentioned his giving of the lectures in America and New York that became the book Major Trends happened during this period. During the destruction of European Jewry, and as you mentioned, people who were close to Scholem, what was his life like and what was his unfolding thinking about the Holocaust as it was happening?
Well, to understand Scholem's thoughts or feelings about the Holocaust, I think we should go back practically to the role, which is not in my book, but to the role of the First World War in Scholem's life. The First World War served really as a traumatic point in Scholem, for Scholem's back then young biography, or and he saw or all that he saw and experienced, inclusive his own drafting to the army and getting out on the excuse of having a mental illness, which he claimed to have been faked, but it's not clear to what extent it was faked or not. His reaction were of a total despair, a personal despair, and a very difficult personal moment. And those things we see exactly come back during the Second World War. It was like a relapse to what he experienced before. He is talking in his private diaries, he's talking about suicide, about being lonely, about all the hopes that he had in his youth were lost and are lost. And of course, it is understandable in face of the measures of the destruction that and the fear and anxiety that in which the Yeshuv, the Jewish population in the land of Israel, was feeling at the time. There are not many sources that reveal Scholem's feeling during this time. He was productive. He wrote, as you rightly mentioned, he had shortly before the war his lectures in New York, which afterwards became his book. But in 1944, he wrote a very curious article about thoughts about Jewish studies, Mitoch Hirurim al Chochmat Israel, in which he criticizes in a very vehement, in a very picturesque and morbid language, the previous generations of science of Judaism, of Jewish studies. And he said that actually all their intention was to bury Judaism in their apologetic attitude towards the German academic world. And they wanted to hide away all irrational elements in Judaism. And as he said, to give Judaism actually a decent burial in that sense. In this article from 1944, he blames Zionism or Zionist science that actually didn't manage to change anything in that sense. So to say, Zionism wanted to give a different science of Judaism, something that would not be apologetic, that would not feel ashamed for Jewish phenomena, but according to him at the time, nothing have changed, actually. And what you do is the other way, only that this time the apologetic is in the direction of Zionism and not a Jewish national identity and not against Jewish identity. I see, or in my book, I read this article as almost a post-traumatic reaction to the Holocaust. The loss, among many other things, the loss of people, of manpower, of working hands that the Zionist ideology organization was relying upon to build the land, was a devastating fact for Zionism. And Sholem was not excluded from that. And the hopes to build a land seemed, in 1944, to build the homeland, seemed more difficult than ever before. And therefore, I think that this famous article about the science of Judaism is a reaction, in a way, an indirect reaction to the Holocaust.
A large part of this section of this response to the Holocaust focuses on Sholem's heroic efforts after the war in going back to Europe and trying to reclaim some of the property that was then taken from the Jewish communities. And irrespective of his own personal circumstances, you detail this trip and this experience on Sholem's life. This is part of another theme in your book and in Sholem's life, which is his relationship to books. When he arrives in Jerusalem, his first position is as a librarian at the library. And after the war, books played a large part in his life and still exist in the Sholem Library at the National Library till today. Can you reflect first a little bit about this period during that late 40s when Sholem went back to Europe to reclaim these books? And if you can also situate this in the larger frame of his life, his relationship to books, his collecting, and as well as his involvement in the establishment of the National Library.
Sholem was sent after the war, immediately after the war, by the Hebrew University and the National Library, to search for collections of books that were looted by the Nazis and found again by the liberating forces, especially in the American zone. There was not much known, and travel was very difficult at the time, but they took the mission and went trying to enter Germany or to receive a permission to enter Germany, which he didn't. And it was really difficult, and only after 4 months and after going to Switzerland and to Czechoslovakia and back, he received the promised authorization. And entering Germany, he suddenly returned also to the landscapes of his youth, but only this time it was ruined Europe. And searching for the books, for this property of people that were murdered, Jews that were murdered, and at the same time wandering through those devastated landscapes, had a really difficult and heavy influence on him during this period of time. He saw this as a mission, and he wanted, his aim was to get into the small town of Offenbach, next to Frankfurt, on the Main, where there was an archival depot where many of the collected books were put into before returning them into the rightful owners. He wanted to, what Sholem's mission was, to look for books who didn't have any legal owners and to try and plead or try to gain more information in order for the Hebrew University to claim that they're actually the rightful owner, or they represent the murdered Jews to whom these books belong. What happened in Sholem's mind through this trip and all the adventures that he experienced is that slowly the books and the people who owned them became one. And his trip for salvation of books, very as long as his travel extended and was going on, became actually a trip for an attempt, or maybe a Don Quixotean attempt, to save the murdered people, or lament for the unsaved people. And when he arrived in Offenbach, he was sought to receive some kind of a salvation for himself, to some kind of a feeling that he could have done or that he did something, which of course did not happen. And this is what caused, as I show in detail in the chapter in the book, this is what caused actually his almost mental breakdown at the time of this trip. And this is the situation in which he returned back to his home. Fania, his wife, Fania Sholem, said many years afterwards that he was lying for months in his bed and refusing to get out, just trying to understand or to process the all that he saw and the influence of this gloomy sight on him. So books did always have a central role in Sholem's life, of course. But it was in this point where I think their role as representing of something else was the most acute one. The books of the looted, of the books of the murdered Jews that were looted by the Nazis seemed to him as standing for the people who owned them.
The final section in your book focuses on Sholem's return to Germany and his reception there. And you begin this with your interest in the Eranos Conference. Can you just describe for us a little bit further, you mentioned it previously, what exactly the Eranos Conference was, and really what Sholem's role was in it, and why it's important for his biography?
Eranos were conferences that were yearly conferences that were established at the southern Swiss town of Ascona by a rich young lady named Olga Forbe-Kaptan, and with the support of the psychologist Carl Gustav Jung. The Eranos conferences started in the early 30s, and of course then Sholem was not part of it yet. But it had a lot to do with the place, and more exactly that Ascona was really lying to the foot of a small hill that was called Monte Verita. And Monte Verita was at the time of the First World War, at the turn of the century, in the time of the First World War, a place of refuge for almost every external weird outsider, outlaw tradition, European tradition. If it would have been nudist or Rosicrucians or naturalist or vegetarians or dance groups, they all gathered on this hill in different groups. There was also a sanatorium there to treat alcoholism. Hermann Hesse was a regular visitor to the sanatorium. And although by the time that Eranos started, this center at Monte Verita did not exist anymore, on the rest of it, the this place of encounter remained. And this is why, or the reason why, Olga Forbe-Kaptan decided to start her project, her meetings there. And the idea was to invite every year scholars from from the East and from the West to meet there and discuss topics of religious studies. And the topics varied every year. There was a different topic. But this was an exclusive group. As I said, there were 10 days and 10 speakers, and the rest of the people came as listeners. And because of the format, they were very attractive to almost to every scholar that was invited to it. And really after, or actually when Sholem arrived in 1946 on a trip searching for the looted books, he arrived in Switzerland and he met Carl Gustav Jung. And Jung was impressed by him and gave his name further to Olga for the Kaptan, and she invited him to participate in 1947. And of course, because of the events in Israel at the time, the War of Independence, he could not travel, but promised or asked to be invited again in the future. And so it came that in 1949, he participated there for the first time. And then he remained there or came almost every year for the next 30 years. And some of his most intriguing, path-breaking researches in Kabbalah were based on lectures that he gave at Eranos. Socially, of course, this was a wonderful platform for someone coming from the small and isolated Israel to meet and to speak in the German language with colleagues from Switzerland, from Germany, with the same field of interest. So this circle was something that did not exist in Israel at the time. And he could only do that or enjoy that traveling and coming to the lecture. With the years, he became one of the central figures of this circle and one of the elders of the tribe, and also influenced its structure. Because of the circle's affiliation with Jung, Sholem was criticized in Israel for participating in it, and also criticized for his friendship with other participants like Mircea Eliade, the Romanian author and scholar who was accused of being part of the fascist groups in Romania in the 1930s. So he dealt with that, and he, on the one hand, protected his participation in Eranos, but on the other hand, also changed his mind about, for example, about Eliade after the facts were known to him. So this was a group or a social network that had a lot to offer to Sholem on the one hand, but on the other hand, he always had to be apologetic or to explain it in Israel.
We return now to the influence of Holocaust on Sholem's life. The second chapter of this part of your book, Sholem's Return to Germany, actually occurs in Jerusalem, and that is the Eichmann trial. Can you tell us a little bit about why the Eichmann trial was important for Sholem's life?
Well, the Eichmann trial was, of course, important for the history of Israel and the Israel intellectual world, or at all the Jewish intellectual world. But where Sholem's come to the picture is actually with Hannah Arendt's report about the Eichmann trial, the Proton Banality of Evil, which was published first in the New Yorker and then as a book, and to which Sholem wrote a very vehement critique, which became one of the most prominent documents of this debate with Hannah Arendt. Among others, because to Sholem, Hannah Arendt answered what she refrained to do in many other cases. This event, which would actually mark the end of the relationship of Hannah Arendt and Gershom Sholem, or the friendship between the two, I use in order to examine the relationship of both sides, of Hannah Arendt and Gershom Sholem, in relation to the Holocaust, to see how both the different reactions and perceptions of Eichmann and of the trial actually reflect different understandings of Jewish history and Zionism. Also, they reflect a very complex relationship between two great intellectuals that is very, in many ways, very ambivalent. Sholem and Arendt were very close to each other, but this closeness and also produced almost instinctively a distance or a need to emphasize a sort of a distance. Therefore, I describe this relationship in the book as some kind of a mask dance, a dance in which each one of the parties intellectually, of course, put masks on and off in order to reveal and hide his personality and his closeness or his distance from his colleague, his friend, actually, his contemporary. For Scholem himself, this is another confrontation with the Holocaust and with the post-Holocaust or the memory of the Holocaust afterwards, of course. And this is central, as I said, this is a central part of his life, since he didn't write anything directly about the Holocaust. Always have to look for indirect texts from which one can understand the role of the Holocaust in his life.
As you mentioned, this relationship with Hannah Arendt, something that goes back to his youth, and in many ways their lives mirror one another, particularly in their departure from Germany and their continued relationship to German thought. One of the interesting dialogues is about politics. And for those who know Scholem as a academic scholar of the study of Kabbalah, this may be surprising. Can you tell us a little bit about Scholem's politics in the later part of his life?
Yes. Well, officially or externally or allegedly, Scholem's political activity ended actually in 1929 after Brit Shalom, as a political association, disintegrated. He refrained from participating in any political organization. He was quite critical of Zionism as well, from and the way Zionism was established at the State of Israel. His article on the Star of David shows a lot of implement critique on the Israeli society in 1949 at its beginning. And this criticism grew with the time. But interesting enough, when someone more critical than him came to the picture, like Hannah Arendt, very often Scholem chose to take the opposite opinion or the opposite direction, the one that actually protects or defends Israeli politics. It is difficult to say or to put the finger exactly on where the real Scholem stands. No, there is the critic part and there is the part, the apologetic part or the defensive part. And I think both should be being taken as seriously when we consider his life and his character. But in my book, what I try to show is that Scholem's movement back towards Germany reflects actually two changes or ongoing changes in the two different poles of his life. On the one hand, in Israel, there was growing critique and alienation from the political way, and 1977 is another point in this process. And on the other hand, the warmth and the place that was accorded to him by his German colleagues, which was a place of admiration and being regarded as an, not only, as I said, not only as an authentic Jew, but as an authentic Berliner, as a more German than any other German, which is also ironical in many ways that Gershom Scholem, who left Germany as a Zionist Jew, returns to it as a Berliner German. But this is the way that I saw it from the texts, from the sources.
If you can continue and expand on that point, I was quite interested in something that I hadn't known much about, and that was Scholem's reception in Germany, not only as an intellectual figure, but also as a popular figure. What was this reception like, and how did it differ between intellectual circles and popular circles?
Well, I think that Scholem's reception, let me start with saying that I think that Scholem's reception in Germany was at the end limited also. So he was at the end being appreciated mostly among the circles of intellectuals and academics. But it was a wide circle, and the love or the admiration to him was not only on the academic level. It was, and in that sense, it was popular because it was his character. Scholem's arrival to Germany in the 60s, his entering into the German intellectual or consciousness, came over the memory of Walter Benjamin and editing the letters of Walter Benjamin together with Theodor Adorno. And this volume, which was published around the student revolt of 1968, gave or brought not only Benjamin's name into the consciousness and part of the admiration, but also Scholem's name. And Scholem's appeared in Germany, or his presence in Germany, was almost as a revelation. It was almost as he offered an answer for a generation, for a confused generation of young German scholars. The German students of the time, of the 1960s and 70s, could not really, did not have actually a generation of fathers, of teachers, upon which they could, to which they could look up to and admire, and upon which they could rely. Always, there was always the question there, what did they do in the time, in the Nazi time? And there was always not, it was always not clear to the younger generation if you could really trust and rely on those professors morally. And Gershom Scholem offered a clear solution to that. He was not part of all that. He was Jewish, but at the same time, he was born in Berlin. He was German. He was speaking a dialect that was not known anymore, since at the end of the 60s, there was a wall splitting the Spittelmark, the neighborhood in which he was born, which had a special dialects of its own, and Gershom Scholem spoke it and could tell jokes that were very much from his own time and evoked in the German colleagues, also in the younger ones, nostalgia to the time of Germany because it, before it became corrupted. And this was his charm. This was his power over his colleagues. On, you can add to that that he came from, he was Jewish, of course, and in that sense, he opened the window or access to the one of the most difficult issues at the time. First of all, Judaism, and secondly, Israel, which was for many German the most difficult state to deal with because, of course, of the history. And in that sense, Scholem and his life story were both very interesting and very fascinating and very useful to German, to the German audience at the time. And his writings in German begin, of course, with the field of Kabbalah, and he wrote always about Kabbalah, but we see there what you don't see in Israel and you didn't see in America as well, that very soon he turns to write and sometimes to combine his research with autobiographical observation. It is not true that Scholem was only a researcher of Kabbalah. You can also look at Scholem as a contemporary historian who writes about Judaism at the turn of the century and at the beginning of the 20th century. This he did quite a lot in German, and combined with that his own memoirs and episodes from his own life and experience from before and the Holocaust.
Perhaps the major theme in your book, or one of the major themes in your book, is the quote-unquote German-Jewish dialogue. What is the German-Jewish dialogue? What was Scholem's thinking about it? and did it change?
Well, the German Jewish dialogue was a notion that came up after the Holocaust in the early 60s in order to describe and the relationship or sort of a relationship that Jews and Germans had before the Holocaust. Scholem was very critical to that, and it all started with an invitation to write, to have a contribution to a festschrift in honor of the German writer, Jewish writer who lived in Switzerland, Margarete Sussmann. And the theme of the festschrift was the unbreakable German Jewish dialogue. Gershom Scholem refused to participate in this or to have a normal contribution to this volume, but he wrote a letter to the editor, which was published in the volume. In his letter, he said that actually the notion of a German-Jewish dialogue is a blasphemy because there was never a dialogue there. There was only the voices, the Jewish voices who wanted to be part of the German society and the German voices that were actually at the end rejecting this wish to participate. And it was not a dialogue, but it was a desperate call or a monologue of Jews of wanting to be part of something, which ended in the most tragic way. This article was the beginning of a debate and a sequence of articles that were dealing with this question and elaborating on this point of the non-existing German-Jewish dialogue and about the notion of its being existing. The ironical thing about it, and also the interesting one, is that in many ways, Scholem's talking about a non-existent German-Jewish dialogue before the Holocaust, this whole debate itself, was the beginning of a German-Jewish dialogue after the Holocaust. He didn't write these articles in English or in Hebrew, and some of them were not even translated into Hebrew until today. They were all written in German, and they were all aiming at the German audience. So, with the years, and until really until the late 70s, until almost Scholem's death, they were always elaborating. The last one was also published in English, but in parallel in German. But the aim was basically to have some kind of a talk or a conversation about this non-existing conversation.
You mentioned earlier the renewed interest in Scholem from a number of different angles. What do you attribute this new interest to, and how do you situate your own book in terms of the recent scholarship?
I think that the research, or what Scholem has to offer the researcher that not many scholars can offer, is on one hand the vast amount of material that is in the archive, which reflects about his huge interest in so many different topics. As I mentioned, Gershom Scholem, Kabbalah research was only part of Gershom Scholem's activity. You can see him also as a letter writer. The correspondence in Scholem archive have until now nourished many volumes and that were published in different languages, and there's still a lot in there. His diaries that were published in English and reflect the time of around the First World War, also historical research dealing with contemporary issues, also attending contemporary problem or referring to contemporary problem in academic debates and political debates. And all this makes him a very rich scholar with many different faces. On the other hand, it's really difficult to put the finger on who's really Scholem, which makes it, of course, very intriguing. And it opens a window to many different understandings of his character and figure. What my book is doing, whereas a lot has been written about Cholem's research and also his relationship to his research, there is no book or monograph that deals with Cholem as a person, as an immigrant, a very prominent immigrant with all this intellectual background that he has, but as a someone who was actually making Aliyah, moving from Berlin and moving from Jerusalem and looking at what was his reaction, what was his relationship to his Zionism and to his land of origin after doing this great step. Everyone who moved from one country to another knows that you always remain in a sort of dialogue and relationship with your country that you left, especially if you were born there. And it always has a place in your mind. Zionism, the demand of Zionism was to create a new homeland, something to replace that. And what I wanted to show is that with the great Gershom Scholem, like with any other, this was not an easy process. And of course, his sharp intellect and vast knowledge makes the manifestations of all those processes very, very rich and very diverse. And it is this book, the aim of the book is to discover them and to show them through a different, very different types of text and from different perspectives. The perspective he's taking is not always the one of Scholem, and the last chapter, very often, the perspective is also of his German contemporaries and the way they perceive him and see him. So there is many views, many different gazes at this figure, Scholem, but not only as an intellectual, of course as an intellectual, and of course understanding also his work in the context of his biography, but actually mainly as a person who is living, an intellectual who is living between two worlds.
To conclude, you open your book by questioning the very different images of Scholem that you confronted in Israel and in Germany. And I was wondering if you could, looking back at the book, see how you answered this, and what exactly were these different receptions? Why was it so troubling to see them? And how were you able to solve this riddle?
The puzzling was about the fact that starting this project of this book and arriving from Israel, I came with a certain image of Scholem as a very formidable, strict and rigid professor. And arriving in Germany and talking to people, I received a whole different image of almost a nice grandpa or someone who is really a good friend and tender and with sense of humor. And actually, it's true that throughout the book, I try to find or reconcile between this this gap in between these two images that existed at the same time. I have to say at the beginning that I think that it's not every contradiction could or should be solved. And I don't have a definite solution to that. I think that it is quite fair to let the historical Scholem exist in a parallel with parallel figures, parallel characters in two parallel worlds. But if there will be a solution, I think that it has to be, we had to look for it in the role that Scholem played in both countries. Whereas on the one hand, in Israel, he was a university professor and a scholar, an academic. And a lot of his work, a big part of his work, were really in the academic field. He built the academic field of Kabbalah. Whereas in Germany, his role was of a German writer. With all the attributes and all everything that accompanies this title. A writer, with his writing, is aiming to connect generations and to provide and give some kind of continuity within the society within she or he are acting. And this was in Germany the case with Schollen by, as I described before, by serving as a bridge that is linking the present German intellectual world with its good past before the Holocaust, before the great moral deterioration, or at the time, Scholem, okay, let me rephrase that. Scholem served as a bridge between the contemporary Germany and the German past with the Germans wanted to be connected to. He bridged over the Nazi time, the dark time, the time of corruption, into a German with which his contemporaries could identify, the younger German generation. And by providing this bridge, he offered mitigation of this big abyss that existed in German German history for many of the younger intellectuals. By doing that, he provided them a possibility to move forward and to go on and move on the line of continuity of generation in Germany. This is a role of a writer in many ways. Just like Scholem himself described the role of Agnon and Bialik in the early years of Zionism as bridging, being a bridge to the older Hebrew language, and by that providing continuity. And therefore, while his role was a different one, his also his reaction and his the way he behaved and acted was also different. And therefore, this is where I see the difference between the two Scholem. On one hand, a professor in Germany, a writer.
I would like to end our interview today by thanking Noam for joining us on the Jewish Studies channel of the New Books Network. I'm Moses Lappin, your host, and we've been talking about his new book, Gershon Scholem, From Berlin to Jerusalem and Back, an intellectual biography published by Brandeis University Press in 2018.